Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:59 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time, Standard Time. Today is November 30th, and of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. There is a lot to talk about this week. We've had a very eventful week in terms of market action. And the things that I'd like to cover in particular are the medium to long-term outlook for Wall Street. How does that fit into the performance of other assets, most particularly some of the European, Japanese, Chinese markets, the emerging markets? So that's then going to cover the vast majority of the global population. Then we should also look at the bond market. There's been a lot going on there. The commodity markets are also worthy of consideration, considering just how much oil prices have declined recently. And then, of course, we need to think about what is the outlook for currencies, and try to put all of that in terms of the big long-term picture. Well, the one thing that I think is most important, it's something that I was talking about with delegates at one of the breaks at the chart seminar. There have been a couple of occasions over the years where I've seen very clear indications of extreme optimism or extreme pessimism. So, generally speaking, when I get an email from a subscriber telling us how great we are, that we've identified a bull market and that it has been extraordinarily rewarding for the subscriber, that's generally an indication that we're close to the end. When I write something that's bearish about something that's been accelerating higher, and I then get emails telling me what a fool I am to even think that there's the possibility that the thing can't continue to rise at an amazing pace, well, then that's generally speaking an indication that things are getting a bit too hot and that we're close to a peak. Well, I'm seeing something like that today, because I have never seen so many bearish reports cross my desk. The only time that has been in any way comparable to the amount of bearishness that's being expressed today was in the immediate aftermath of the credit crisis in late 2008 and early 2009, where the abiding characteristic among people was that the other shoe was going to drop, that the market was not going to be able to hold its lows, and that that there were going to be mass bankruptcies. And of course, what that told us was that there were a lot of people already in cash. There were a lot of people that had experienced a very deleterious effect on their portfolios. They were adopting a vindictive attitude towards the market. The last thing they wanted to see was it to continue to rise. And that also told us that they had already sold. Well, what are we seeing today? Well, there's always in the military field, there is a tendency for the generals to fight the last war. Well, what I can see at the moment is that among the investment community, most particularly among people writing investment reports, is that they want to ensure that they do not make the same mistake this time that they made last time. And the mistake that the vast majority of analysts made last time was to ignore any sign at all that we were entering an economic contraction. So today, every time there is any kind of contraction in the yield curve spread, then it makes headlines. Then we also have people being very clear that this is a late in the cycle move and that there are clear risks to the downside. And then you have also people being very conservative with their estimates for what we can expect next year. Well, that also feeds through to one of the things that we talk about at the chart seminar, which is how do you predict markets? Well, the reality is the vast majority of people predict what they see. So if they've seen ranging, well, then they're going to predict ranging. If they see an uptrend, well, then they're going to predict that the uptrend will persist. If they see a downtrend, they're going to predict that it will persist. But that's simply confirmation bias. That is also recency bias, they simply think that their most recent exposure to the market is reflective of what they can continue to expect. Well, that is very similar to what Marianne Evans read in, wrote in Middlemarch, where she said, "Our deeds travel with us from afar, and what we have been makes us what we are." So that doesn't mean that we need to ignore the fact that we are late in the cycle. I think the fact is, I've been saying that we've been late in the cycle now for over a year, that we are in the third psychological perception stage of this medium-term bull market. So I'd like to think that I've been relatively early in terms of highlighting that condition. But at the moment, there isn't a great deal of evidence to suggest that we are at the end. I'm rather tempted to think that there is the potential here for the market to break higher in the short term, potentially the medium term, and that it isn't until we start to see the Federal Reserve starting to hike rates a bit more aggressively that we're likely to really see some downward pressure starting to come through in here. But I think it is also very instructive to look at this long-term trend of the S&P 500, because what it highlights for us is that there is a cyclicality to the to what we can expect from stock markets. They do tend to go sideways for upwards of 20 years and sometimes longer than that. And then they break out. And when they break out, then you tend to get bull markets that can persist for really quite significant periods of time. So, for example, we had a very significant break above the 20 level in 1950 for the S&P 500, and it eventually peaked in 1973. So that was a 23-year bull market. And then it broke out to new highs again in 1980. It pulled back, and in fact into the range. When we look at the Dow Jones, it didn't quite pull back all the way into the range, but it broke out in 1980 and it hit a very meaningful peak in 1999. So that's essentially a 20-year bull market. Well, we also know that the market has broken out, and it did so in 2013. Well, if that's the case, then the chances are that we're going to have a 20-year secular bull market. Therefore, when we're starting to think about the next big crash, the next really meaningful move that's likely to precipitate a decade or longer of ranging, well, it's unlikely that we're going to get that kind of event occurring in the short term, but rather that if the breakout occurred in 2013, well, we're 5 years into a significant secular bull market. Well, we can also see that historically that there have been really quite meaningful pullbacks in the course of these secular bull markets. And even here, this was the 1987 crash, and that was an extraordinarily meaningful pullback, which was unwound within a year of the major decline. Well, that also helps to ram home the point that there is an enormous difference between a secular bull market and a secular bear market. These very lengthy, volatile periods of ranging represent periods of secular stagnation. And that is when you can see extraordinarily large moves relative to the underlying fundamentals. But if this is a secular bull market, well, then you can't have a secular bull market without two things. Probably the most important of those is productivity growth. You need productivity growth. That is an absolute must-have for a secular bull market. And there is a big argument going on out there as to whether we do in fact have productivity growth. We certainly have had liquidity provision, and this has been an enormously liquidity driven advance off the lows from 666, but and that is something that is now beginning to change. But we also know that technology is advancing at a really very impressive clip, and that is contributing to the potential for really very significant productivity growth. Now, what is it that are the main parts of that? Well, autonomous vehicles alone, it could be an incredible change in terms of personal productivity. If people don't have to spend 2 to 3 hours a day in their cars driving, then that time can be taken up with more productive pursuits. So that's certainly one thing. But that's only a small corner of the potential that autonomous vehicles could potentially deliver. Then, of course, you have the fact that if you have electric vehicles, well, they tend to have fewer parts, last longer, and then they're being engineered for upwards of 500,000 miles. So they are also starting to be. That even if we don't have autonomous vehicles, then the chances are that we're going to have a lot more of the kind of Lyft and Uber type arrangements, so that there'll be car sharing. Again, if you're not driving the car yourself, you have the potential to be more productive. Well, these are just two of the potential things that could drive this move faster. But of course, autonomy in terms of transportation is an offshoot of the really impressive pace of innovation that we're getting in deep learning and in artificial intelligence. So those are two incredibly important factors. They're almost, I think, as important for the future productivity growth potential of the global economy as the development of the internet was. Well, that also then goes through to cloud computing and this massive data aggregation that is continuing to go on. Well, the application of massive data aggregation to the healthcare sector, and most particularly into genetics, is another a really very impressive potential productivity growth enhancer. You have companies like Human Longevity Inc. that are revolutionizing the diagnostics sector, so that it has the real potential to completely change the diagnostic sector. And that can reduce healthcare costs, because if you can find things faster and earlier, well, then the cost of treatment is reduced. And we need to come up with a way of reducing costs in the healthcare sector. Well, that is a potential answer. And there will be other potential answers. So that's an additional thing, that's an additional aspect to the growth of artificial intelligence. Well, then if we look at the energy sector, we've already seen news stories to the effect that artificial intelligence and modeling has been very effective in modeling the kind of solar flare activity that occurs inside a fusion reactor, because the creation of a plasma field using magnets within a tokamak tends to have the same kind of solar flares that the sun has. They've been able to model those with Google's analytics. But the main point is that used to take weeks to do one model, whereas the Google model can do a couple a day. So that's massively accelerating the pace of innovation as a result of this deep learning. Well, it's also going to create a map of the human mind, or the I think perhaps more correctly, the brain. There is more data contained in one map of one human brain than all of the computing capacity that Google has today. So that is an order of magnitude are several orders of magnitude greater than the kind of data collection, aggregation, and analysis that is currently underway. Well, it also tells us where the direction of exploration is going to be going. Well, if we're thinking then about what is the likely to be the driving force behind a secular bull market, it's going to be technological innovation. And that's not unusual, because it was technological innovation that helped to drive and eventually led to the climax of the last secular bull market. And it was also technological innovation that helped to drive the one in the 50s and 60s. So what that tells us is that secular bull markets tend to be driven by productivity growth, and productivity growth is delivered by technological innovation. So if we're looking for productivity growth, then we need to be looking at technology. And if technology really is improving at such a rapid rate, well, then we need to be thinking about secular bull markets. So if things are really that rosy, why is everybody worried? That's the really big question. Well, of course, they're worried because we've borrowed an enormous amount of money to generate this initial portion of the secular bull market. So now the big question is what happens next? Because 10-year treasury yields have been trending down for an awfully long time, and now they are above this 3% area. Well, this week they're closing below 3%. So that's a reasonably meaningful move. Well, we had the chairman of the Federal Reserve say this week that interest rates are very close to the neutral bound. Well, they're obviously giving themselves some cover because back at the beginning of October he said they were a long way from the neutral bound. So either the neutral bound has decreased over that time. Well, it could potentially have done so because inflationary pressures have certainly moderated because oil prices have fallen almost $30 in the course of the last 6 weeks. But it's also almost Jesuitical that they give themselves a lot of leeway to say what is the neutral bound. It could be anything from 2.75% to 3.75%. Well, if the federal funds rate is currently at 2.25%, well, that's only 50 basis points from the lower side of that bound. If they raise again in December, well, it's only going to be one hike away. So that's what we're starting to see priced into the market, that the market is starting to move from what JP Morgan was anticipating, that there would be four interest rate hikes next year. The market is now pricing in that there may be one. Well, if we only get one and the Federal Reserve avoids a recession, and then we have the potential that inflationary pressures are starting to come off the boil, that is certainly what the TIPS spread is starting to tell us. I've never seen anyone else look at this, so I created it because I was curious. What is the yield curve equivalent of the spread on the TIPS market? And it is now inverted. In fact, it inverted back in June. Well, what that suggests is that there is less demand for inflation protection, but more particularly, it's that inflationary pressures are probably going to be higher in the short term than the market is pricing in over the long term. So what that is now starting to suggest is that investors are no longer starting to worry about inflation. And that could be deemed to have two different potential reasons. Well, the first, that could be that it's because oil prices have been coming down. It's because the Federal Reserve is starting to think about less interest rate hikes. Well, it could also be because that the what was it? The jobs rate has or the unemployment rate at the very beginning of this week popped on the upside. Well, general Motors decided that they were going to fire 10,000 workers. That was certainly something that attracted a great deal of interest. There we go. It's the jobless claims. I knew that claims was somewhere in the title. Could not remember what it was. Well, if we look at jobless claims, we can see that it trended lower in a very dynamic manner from 2009 onwards. It would be hard to imagine we're going to have a recession without it breaking on the upside. And I'm going to update that to this week. So when we look at these jobless claims, it suggests that there is the potential here that that we could have a pop on the upside. Well, if that feeds through eventually into the unemployment rate, well, moving higher, well, then that could lead to a lead indicator for a recession. So there is no denying that we are in the latter stages of this medium-term bull market, and that credit conditions are starting to tighten up. That if we look at the yield curve spread, it is currently at approximately 22, well, it's at 20 basis points as I'm recording now, and it is trending down. So it's inevitable that it is going to become inverted at some point over the course of the next 12 months. Now the big question is if the 10-year yield is below 3%, how long is it going to take the 2-year yield to then respond as well? What this suggests to me is that it is looking increasingly likely that the 2-year yield is at least going to unwind its overextension relative to the trend mean. So what that I think suggests is that if we look at these 2-year Treasury futures, then there is a strong likelihood that we're going to see an additional rally in here. And considering just how consistent this decline has been, that it is becoming less consistent. There is definitely a case that it was accelerating lower, and that people are now starting to price in the potential that the Federal Reserve is towards the end, or at least a hiatus in terms of its hiking cycle. If now we're at a point where there are the other things that people have been worried about, the other thing that people have been worried about is trade. Well, the G20 is this weekend, and there is the potential that the Trump and Xi meeting is going to result in an announcement that they're at least talking again, that there is the potential for some form of agreement. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it is going to be a lasting agreement, or that it is something that China is going to hold true to, or that they're suddenly about to give up on industrial espionage, or that they're going to start upholding intellectual property rights. But if we do get a form of an agreement where the US and China are getting back to talking again and are starting to think more about cooperation and amelioration of their differences rather than widening differences, then that's likely to be greeted with enthusiasm by the investment community and the global community. But it's also likely to moderate inflationary pressures because there is nothing like additional tariffs on goods to push the price up on everything. So that's certainly an additional aspect to this market that I think we need to pay attention to, that it could potentially be a significant bullish catalyst. But what that therefore I think also highlights is that there is potential here, that this ranging environment that has been underway for all of this year, where we have a progression of higher reaction lows within the range, could be resolved with an additional move on the upside. That this very impressive medium-term bull market could be resolved with, I think, it could potentially be resolved with an acceleration on the upside. Now, if we do get that, well, then we could move into a multi-year process of consolidation, Well, now the question is for the Federal Reserve. Are they going to risk additional underperformance now, or are they going to risk bigger underperformance later? Well, if history is any guide at all, then central banks will almost unwaveringly favor more problems later because they are retrospective in terms of their actions. So I think that is a potential outcome here. Well, of course, there is the potential that this meeting with Xi is going to be a disaster, that they're going to walk away and say that they're not going to talk any longer, that they will introduce 25% tariffs in January, and that that will have a deleterious effect on sentiment, and that would represent a failure in the region of the trend mean for the S&P 500, which would then start, I think, reversing bets that we're going to see it break up on the upside, and that then we could start thinking about it going on the downside. So we're at a rather critical juncture for a number of these markets. But one thing that is rather encouraging is when we look at two of the weakest currencies in Asia, the Indonesian rupiah has now firmed through its trend mean. The Indian rupee has also unwound its overextension relative to the trend mean and done so in a pretty emphatic manner. Well, that suggests that there is some buying pressure starting to come back in here. Well, China has got a lot of headaches. Not only have they got this trade war that they're working on, but they're also weighing in on their shadow banking sector. And this liquidity issue within the Chinese banking sector is a significant problem. I think everyone today is focusing on the risks that we have in the USA, but the risks we have in China are a multiple of what are in the USA, because the one thing that is, I think, very much in the USA's favor right now, one is the outperformance of its markets. But then you have the fact that the consumer deleveraged during the credit crisis and the banking sector was deleveraged in the aftermath of the credit crisis, where you have clear leverage and a massive transfer of leverage was from the private sector and the banking sector to the sovereign. So it's the US government is massively indebted, and its US corporations have taken on an enormous amount of debt. And the ability of those companies to pay back that debt is very much influenced by where the outlook for interest rates is, when that debt needs to be refinanced, and what the level of the interest rate is going to be when it needs to be refinanced. So when we look at that particular question, well, the high yield sector has broken on the upside. So excuse me, the high yield spread has now broken on the upside. That is the first sign that we are starting to see some pressure coming to bear on the high yield sector. Well, the difficulties that GE is experiencing are in no small part responsible for this move, because it's a massive issuer of debt and it's going to be downgraded to junk. Well, that represents when we think about the supply of high yield debt, when you get a massive issuer like GE being downgraded into the high yield sector, then competition within the sector is going to demand higher yields, considering that its unsubordinated debt, excuse me, its subordinated debt is trading at 16.5%. When GE is eventually downgraded to high yield status, well, then it's going to have a considerable effect on the high yield spread because of just the size of that market. Well, that's a significant issue. But there are other issues. And one of the things that I think is quite important is the fact that high yield debt is rising, and it's not just in the USA. In fact, the issues with high yield debt in China have been much, I think, more. I think, well, when we just look at the chart, we can see the clear difference that the yield, high yield spreads in China have been trending higher all year. So that's clearly different, but it's completely out of kilter with the emerging markets. Now, one thing that I find particularly interesting is when we look at the constituents of the MSCI Emerging Markets ETF, then we can see that Tencent, Alibaba, China Construction Bank, China Mobile, Baidu, Ping An, ICBC, these represent some of the largest constituents of the index. And if you continue to go down through it, then China now represents a very large weighting within the emerging markets index. So that has represented a clear bearish phenomenon for the index over the course of the last year. The only reason that it has been rallying over the course of the last few weeks has been because of this bounce we've seen in Tencent. So that's now at least unwinding its oversold condition relative to the trend mean. But this week, Brazil broke out to new all-time highs. And there is definitely evidence there of a bad tick. So when we look at this index here, it's clearly in a bullish environment. But of course, the real was so weak over the course of the last few years that it is much, I think, more correct to look at it in terms of a US dollar denominated move. But here we have it firming from the region of the trend mean. And that also helps to highlight the fact that it's when you get the currency and the stock market in your favor, that's when international investors get really excited about emerging markets. It's very similar when we look at Indonesia. The Indonesian market looks like it's been mostly going sideways in nominal terms, but in US dollar terms, it's been a lot more volatile and it spent most of this year trending down. Well, now it's back above its trend mean. There's certainly evidence of a short-term overbought condition right now, but this has been a very meaningful move, which has broken the downtrend. So that's another source of, I think, optimism that a lot of the selling pressure that has been a very significant feature of the emerging market environment is ebbing here. Well, when we look at what's going on in India, India is has got certainly it's got a bad loan problem, and that is being tackled by the RBI and most particularly by weighing in on the private sector banks. It certainly hasn't touched the state lenders. That's probably too much of well, it's I would say it's probably like a Gordian knot from the perspective of regulation. But the Nifty has bounced from the 10,000 level. The banking sector, which has been a lead indicator for the wider market for much of the last decade, is also back above its trend mean. But when we look at the relative performance of some of the banks, well, we can see that there is clear differences here. That Yes Bank down 46%, while ICICI is up 13%. That's not even looking at the most extreme. And yet, the index is still doing reasonably well in here. Well, India is looking progressively like it's going to start adopting a more manufacturing-friendly environment. There is practically nothing more important for India that with a population of 1.3 billion that is still growing and a population where half the people, in other words, 650 million people are under the age of 25, they need jobs and lots of them. So manufacturing is going to be a national priority for the foreseeable future. But manufacturing is something else that could be transformative for the Indian economy because of the effect it would have on the current account deficit. India has been running current account deficits forever, and that has represented an existential threat to the currency. The rupee has done pretty much nothing but trend lower. But if India can get manufacturing off the ground, then that export revenue is something that will transform the country's finances. Well, if you get the currency in your favor, then that is the kind of environment where you will get a very exciting bull market evolving in India. So this rebound we've seen from the recent lows is now coming back to the first area of potential resistance at for the dollar at the upper, or well, for the rupee at the upper side of this range here. Now the big question is whether it can follow through on the upside, but if we do see rupee strength, then that's likely to be a very powerful siren call for international investors to look at India. And of course, it has the demographic dividend. Well, one of the things that people never tire of writing about is the power of demographics. Well, Europe has got terrible demographics, and Japan has got terrible demographics. Well, Europe is increasingly rebelling against the idea of immigration because they don't like where the immigrants are coming from. And certainly they haven't done a particularly good job of integrating people. In fact, I think integrating people, particularly in places like France and Germany, has been an abject failure. But that has also translated into this big question about the integrity of the Eurozone and the questions that arise as a result of pioneering a political solution without first getting the financials in order. Well, that has translated into this 18-year range for the Euro, or the Stoxx 600, which is a pan-European index. So this continues to look like it has got a lot of work to do to really demonstrate a return to demand dominance. Then, of course, we have these big questions about what's going on in the UK. But the FTSE 100, which is packed full of internationally oriented companies, is now testing the upper side of that underlying trading range. When we look at the mid-cap sector, this has been the sector to own over the course of the last decade, and it is steadying from around this 18,000 level, which represents the upper side of the underlying trading range. What we've also seen is that over the course of the last decade, we've had monetary policy, which has been a gift to asset prices. That has resulted in central bank balance sheets expanding from what were almost inconsequential levels back in 2002 to over 20 trillion at the beginning of this year, and the pace of the decline persists. The size of central bank balance sheets is now at $19.4 trillion. It peaked at the beginning of this year at close to 20.66. So that's a very meaningful decline. And it comes relative to a similar advance in terms of central bank balance sheets that we saw in the previous 6 months. So we've had a very meaningful move. What we're starting to see now is that an increasing number of countries are moving towards fiscal stimulus. The USA has been engaging in fiscal stimulus, and so has the UK. Italy is attempting to engage in fiscal stimulus, and Germany's growth trajectory suggests that they're going to need some form of assistance to arrest the contraction in their economy. Well, what this is beginning to suggest is that we're going to need to see a change in terms of the way that the world is dealing with some of the social challenges that are unfolding. You had Seth Klarman giving a rousing speech at Harvard this week talking about the need for a more broader definition of capitalism. and that the precedence given to shareholder interests is no longer appropriate because of the I think the inequality that is becoming a much more dynamic force within the public consciousness. Then, of course, you have Facebook, which and Instagram, which allows everybody to broadcast and to inflate their living standards, or at least the perception of their living standards online, which creates envy. And that has certainly been a very significant factor over the course of the last few years. But if we get back to the demographics, well, we know that Europe has got poor demographics, and Japan has got the worst demographics of any developed country. But Japan is doing something about it. They are importing workers, but they're being rather picky about who they import. They're certainly not going to have unchecked migration. And the Nikkei has sustained this move above the 20,000 level, and it continues to firm from above the 20,000 level. As long as it is doing that, well, then we can conclude that this is a first step above the base, that there is the potential here that Japan is going to try and solve its demographics by importing workers from the rest of Asia. But with the express aim of making them Japanese in the process. That's a reflection of the kind of migration pattern that the USA used to indulge in. Well, regardless of the kind of immigration pattern that the USA is indulging in today, it doesn't have the same kind of demographic problems that other developed markets have, because it has unchecked migration, and that is contributing a steady flow of young workers. The TOPIX index, on the other hand, got up to a new recovery high at the beginning of this year and pulled back. But it has held on to the majority of its advance, and now we're starting to see some steadying again. It really does need to push back above the 1850 level to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment and to complete what is a generational long range. I think by the time we see this secular bull market evolve in Japan, and I do think that that is a potential outcome, then we will see these indices take out those previous peaks, and that's likely to be a conservative estimate. So these are, I think, important characteristics. If we start to think about where the risks are, well, the risk is certainly in China, that China has got some very acute problems that it needs to deal with. Certainly it has got this issue with non-performing loans. It has an issue with rampant infrastructure development, needed or not, and it has upwards of 50 million homes that are unoccupied. So that's an enormous source of potential supply that is overhanging the market. And the primary avenue for Chinese family to store their wealth has been in property. So that is an additional risk. Well, the one thing that would solve the problems that China has with funding the regions, and it would be to create a property tax. But if they create a property tax, it would likely result in a lot of that supply that's overhanging the market coming back onto the market. So they're rather, I think, impinged in what they can do. So, but there is an additional point with China, and it is that the banking sector is provided annual quotas. So they generally run through their quotas in the first 6 months of the year. And that has contributed to the rise of the shadow banking sector and P2P lending, and they've been weighing on that over the course of this year. But what that means is that there's been a distinct lack of funding in the second half of this year. Well, all of that clock will reset on the 1st of January. So then the banking sector will have lots more capital that it can lend out. So Chinese markets have been trending down just about all year. And I think you'd be brave to say that the downtrend has ended, but certainly the price has steadied around this 2500 area, and that represents the upper side of that underlying trading range. So I think there is the potential here that we could start to see China starting to mimic the performance that we're seeing in some of those other emerging markets, at least at the beginning of next year. It's due a bounce, but it needs probably some form of a bullish catalyst the form of a sign from the administration that there is some form of state sponsorship for a rally, and we don't really have that just yet. If emerging markets are doing better, and the potential is that the USA is going to stop raising interest rates, well, then the big question is whether the pace of the balance sheet runoff is going to persist at the same pace. Because if, or, and that wasn't a particularly well-formed sentence, but there has been a shortage of dollars, and that has been one of the primary facts behind the underperformance of all emerging markets this year. But if we start to see yields coming back down, if we start to see some weakness coming through in the dollar, then that alone is going to have a positive effect on the currency adjusted measure of central bank balance sheets globally, because two facts have been driving that contraction in central bank balance sheets. One is the Fed funds rate, and the fact that the Fed, excuse me, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, which has been contracting. And then you have the additional fact that the dollar has been rallying, which has made the balances sitting on other central banks' balance sheets less valuable. So that's also contributed to this contraction in central bank total assets. Well, if the dollar were to stop rallying, well, then that is going to have a meaningful effect on those central bank balance sheets. It's also going to have an effect on emerging markets, and I think that is what we're starting to begin to see priced in. Well, Europe has got a lot of problems, and the euro is by far the largest constituent of the dollar index. So at 57%, what happens in Europe is going to have a significant effect on what happens on the dollar index. And if China is the epicenter of risk, well, Europe has got to be in there at a very close second. So that's certainly an additional point to bear in mind. But when we look at the Asia dollar index, despite the fact that the renminbi remains under pressure, well, we're starting to see at least some steadying in here. And the constituents of the Asia dollar index are very heavily weighted by the renminbi. So if you look at China and Hong Kong, then you're looking at over 52% of the, or well, almost 52% of the index, whereas the Indonesian rupiah and the Indian rupee are only about 12%. Then we have the Korean won, and the Korean won has been one of the currencies that has not made headlines this year by simply doing nothing at all. Then the Philippine peso has been trending downwards for approximately 5 years already, but it firmed through the trend mean for the first time since January in the course of the last few weeks. Now the question is whether it can hold it. But what we're starting to see is certainly some evidence coming through that some of these currencies, which have been incredibly weak against the dollar, are starting to firm up. Even the Latin American dollar index, which is very concentrated in the Brazilian real and the Mexican peso, has steadied up in here. So when we start to think about it in those terms, obviously you have a populist that is now in charge of Mexico, and that's putting downward pressure on the peso, whereas the Brazilian real has steadied in the region of its trend mean. And the South African rand has strengthened to the region of the trend mean. But now the question is whether they're going to be able to push through them. So these are, I think, rather big questions that there is the potential here that the emerging markets have seen, at least on a spotty basis, the worst of their selling pressure. A lot of that is going to be, I think, very much influenced by what we see out of this Trump-Xi meeting this weekend, and then also about what we see in terms of the Federal Reserve's monetary policy. These, I think, are the big questions, because emerging markets are looking kind of cheap right now. Well, one of the other things that we've seen is that the Nasdaq has gone from being a clear outperformer to an underperformer. That followed the underperformance of the mid-cap sector, and mid-caps globally have been underperforming. So the Russell 2000 has at least stabilized, but it is below its trend mean, and it's below its trend mean for the first time since 2015. So that does tell us that interest rate sensitive sectors have been under a great deal of pressure. And Amazon, which has been, I think, a almost taken on a almost totem characteristics for a lot of investors, has pushed back above the trend mean in here this week. And this has been a meaningful rally off the lows we saw last week. So if Amazon can push back up and sustain a move above its trend mean, well, then that's going to be, I think, something that a lot of people will take heart from, that the technology sector has certainly pulled back, and we've seen a change of leadership. That's as long as they're not trending down, then that's likely to be a positive outcome. What we are seeing is that demand for defensive sectors, which are consumer staples, utilities and telecoms, and healthcare, have all started to pick up. Well, part of the reason for that is exactly because they are defensive, and it's generally in the last stages of a medium-term cycle that you do get defensives doing very well. Well, we're starting to see that happen now. So that's both a positive but potentially a medium-term negative for the market. The big sectors to keep an eye on, though, are going to be those interest rate sensitive sectors. So technology, mid-caps and banks are the most interest rate sensitive sectors. And if they can hold on, or if they can at least range rather than trend down, then that's likely to at least give leeway to the wider market to continue to rally. But if they range and break down, well, then that's going to be a lead indicator for trouble in the future, and potentially would be a rather significant lead indicator for the next recession. So, what's happening in markets in terms of the rotation that's underway right now has both implications from a, I think, a trading and a portfolio perspective, but also from a macro perspective in trying to anticipate when the next problem really will arise. So, I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.